Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Dr. Vinita Raman. She is the clinical director at Barnard Medical Center and also at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And I will be telling you more about her when she comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things in and around the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, this week, I really kind of focused on so much of the divide and anger that's happening in our country. You know, I was listening to an NPR report about racism and Asian Americans who don't feel safe to go out. You know, they're getting blamed for this coronavirus. Our African American brothers and sisters, we know how they have been dealing with racism. Then even just the Democrats versus the Republicans and the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. All of these things just are dividing us, and there's so much anger and there's so little capacity for listening. And I am as guilty as the next person. I am really trying to work on myself and work on listening and fostering kindness and compassion and understanding, but it's challenging. And this week in my email feed, a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh came through, and I thought I would share it with everyone because it's just really beautiful. So it starts like this: smile, breathe, and go slowly. I open my heart and send forth my energy of love and understanding to everyone who has made me suffer, to those who have destroyed much of my life and the lives of those I love. I know now that these people have themselves undergone a lot of suffering and that their hearts are overloaded with pain, anger, and hatred. I know that anyone who suffers that much will make those around them suffer. I know they may have been unlucky, never having the chance to be cared for and loved. Life and society have dealt them so many hardships. They have been wronged and abused. They have not been guided in the path of mindful living. They have accumulated wrong perceptions about life, about me, and about us. They have wronged us and the people we love. I pray to my ancestors in my blood and spiritual families to channel to those persons who have made us suffer the energy of love and protection, so that their hearts will be able to receive the nectar of love and blossom like a flower. I pray that they can be transformed to experience the joys of living, so that they will not continue to make themselves and others suffer. I see that they're suffering and do not want to hold any feelings of hatred or anger in myself toward them. I do not want them to suffer. I channel my energy of love and understanding to them and ask all my ancestors to help them. And I just thought that was so beautiful, and we can really apply that kind of feeling and understanding and prayer to all of the challenges that we're feeling in our life. And I just thought it was beautiful, so I wanted to share that. There's lots of things going on in the news. One of the biggest things is trying to get Congress to pass this Build Back Better Act in Congress. This piece of legislation just will address so many of the issues that we're dealing with in our country and on the planet, having to do with getting off of fossil fuels. It supports incentives for wind and solar. It helps transition communities that are embedded in coal mining into training them for some other work, because one of the things about getting off of some of the fossil fuels is that it puts other people out of work. And so in a compassionate way, we want to find ways to train them for other jobs, because, you know, we're not looking to make anyone suffer, but the planet is really in need of us getting off of these fossil fuels. The carbon emissions from oil, gas, and coal just cannot continue. So this Build Back Better Act, you know, also will help address our agricultural system. It will address our infrastructure. it just addresses so many things. And our country has contributed more to global warming than any other country in the world. And if we want people to take us seriously when President Biden shows up in Glasgow next month for the UN climate talks, he needs to have a bill behind him that shows we're serious, because we have, you know, pulled out of the Paris Agreement. We do not have a good record, and we have added more to global warming than any other country. And so if we're asking other countries to cut back, we need to really show them that we're serious. And President Biden is really taking this on, and he's doing it in a serious way. And this Build Back Better plan is, really needs to get passed. And this is our opportunity while we have the majority in the House and the Senate. We need to really do it, because with the midterm elections coming up, we don't know if we're going to lose that majority. And we need every Democrat to vote for it. And right now, there's two Democrats that are holding out. So take a look at my Take Action. There is a petition you can sign for that. But also just, go on the internet and, become knowledgeable, know what's going on, and find an issue that you really feel passionate about, that you can get behind and work towards making the planet better, because we need all of us conscious people to do that in order to turn things around. And our planet and our children and our grandchildren are depending on us. So we really need to do this, and this is the time to do it. So this Build Back Better Act, it also will support pre-K, universal pre-K. It will support childcare. It will improve healthcare. It's just a lifesaver for so many. So it's really such an important bill. So anything we can all do to help get this passed, please, please do it. I want to share with you this week's recipe, which is one of my favorites. I actually shared it at the beginning of COVID. I was doing some live cooking demos, and this is one of them, but I actually never posted the recipe on my website. It's tempeh and black bean vegetable fajitas with a cashew lime crema. And for this recipe, we're making a bean component, a vegetable component, and a cashew cream sauce. And with these mixtures, you can actually turn them into so many different things. One of the things I love about Mexican food is it can go from a fajita to a taco to an enchilada to a bean burrito. It's all kind of the same stuff. You're just mixing it around. You can also stuff poblano peppers with this. So there's so many different things that you can do with these different parts. So these are the ingredients you need: olive oil or any kind of oil that you want to saute in. A block of tempeh, which is 8 ounces. And if you want to double that up, you can, if you want extra tempeh in there. 2 organic onions chopped and cut into slivers. 2 organic peppers. I like using the red and yellow just to bring in some color. And half of each of those peppers are chopped, and half of them are cut into slivers. And then 1 8-ounce pack of baby Bella mushrooms, or your other favorite mushroom. A tablespoon plus 1 teaspoon of minced garlic, a tablespoon of tamari, which is a wheat-free soy sauce, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon chili powder, 1 teaspoon cumin, 1/2 teaspoon of chipotle chili powder, and that's optional. That's, a little spicy and has a smoky flavor to it, the chipotle peppers. So if you like that flavor, it's great. If you don't, you can just leave it out and maybe add a little extra chili powder. 1 can of organic diced fire roasted tomatoes. I get the ones from Trader Joe's that actually have some chili peppers in it, which also makes it a little spicier. You can just get plain fire roasted tomatoes without chili peppers at Whole Foods if you prefer that. 1 can of organic black beans or refried beans, whichever you prefer. When I use canned beans, I like to use Eden brand because that's the only one that puts kombu in the beans. And kombu is a seaweed and it helps with the digestion and makes beans less gassy. So it's wonderful for you and it's wonderful for everyone around you. So check out Eden beans. 1/2 cup of frozen organic corn, 2 tablespoons of chopped cilantro. If you are a cilantro hater, feel free to substitute parsley. 1 jar of your favorite salsa, one cup of cashews that you're going to soak for 2 hours or more and then drain. However, I want you to know I have also found that if you don't have time to let it soak, you can just pour boiling water over it and it softens the cashews much quicker. And that will work too. But then you want to get the cashew cream cold to put on the sauce. So it's like a sour cream onto the dish and helps cool the dish if it's spicy. Juice of one lime, cilantro for garnish, or again, you can substitute parsley. One chopped red onion, also for garnish, and pickled jalapeno peppers, also optional. You're going to use flour tortillas or corn tortillas or taco shells, depending on which you're doing. And I serve it with taco chips on the side and some guacamole. So you're first going to prepare the beans. You begin by pulsing the tempeh block in a food processor until it's really minced. I lay it out on a cookie sheet and lined with parchment paper and bake it for 10 minutes until it gets golden brown and remove from the oven. And that's a really nice way of toasting the tempeh so that it kind of resembles the look of chopped meat in your beans, but it doesn't absorb any oil that way. So it's a nice way of cooking it without using a lot of oil. Saute chopped onions in some olive oil until translucent. Add a teaspoon of the garlic, half a teaspoon of cumin, half a teaspoon of chili powder, the chopped peppers, and saute those until they're soft. Add the tempeh to the pan and continue sauteing for 5 more minutes. Add the tamari and a half a teaspoon salt. Then add the can of black beans or refried beans and a half a cup of salsa. Lower the heat and let that simmer for a while. In another heavy skillet or wok, you're going to saute the slivered onions in olive oil until translucent. Add the tablespoon of garlic and the mushrooms and sear those for 5 to 10 minutes until well done. Add the colored slivers of peppers, the cumin, the chipotle powder, the chili powder, and half a teaspoon salt, and saute that for another 5 minutes. Then add the frozen corn and fire-roasted tomatoes and continue cooking for another 5 minutes. While that's happening, you can drain the cashews, put them into a mini food processor, add one cup of water, juice of one lime, and a half a teaspoon salt, and just process that until it's completely smooth and silky and looks like sour cream. And then that, like I said, it's nice to serve that room temperature or cold. So if you ended up using boiling water, try to, you know, cool it. You're going to serve that with brown rice. And if you're making tacos, you can serve it with chopped lettuce and tomatoes on the side, along with some of the crema and salsa and some guacamole. If you're making burritos, you can wrap it in some flour tortillas with the crema and the salsa. If you're making tostadas, you're going to fry the corn tortillas open, lay this out flat like a pizza, put all the stuff on top and garnish it with the crema. And if you're making enchiladas, you're going to wrap it in a burrito, lay it in a casserole pan, cover the whole casserole with some salsa and your vegan cheese, or if you eat cheese, regular cheese, and bake that in the oven until melted. And then serve that again with cilantro, salsa, red chopped onion or pickled onion on the side. And again, some guacamole is always great with that. And that is it. I hope you all get to make it and enjoy it, because it's really a great, really quick. I mean, it's a midweek, even though it might sound like a lot, it comes together so quickly. It's great for a midweek meal. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Dr. Vanita Raman. She leads the clinical research team and nutrition education programs at Barnard Medical Center. She provides patient care with an emphasis on plant-based nutrition. Dr. also is a clinical instructor in medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine and frequently speaks at international conferences about the role of nutrition in chronic disease. Dr. Raman is a certified nutritionist and personal trainer and has authored several books on plant-based nutrition and published articles in peer-reviewed medical journals. In her latest book, Simply Plant-Based, Dr. Raman lays out a roadmap for making easy-to-eat plant-based diet, or for making it easy to eat a plant-based diet by providing shopping lists, recipes, and meal plans for creating healthy meals. And it's my pleasure to introduce everyone to Dr. Raman. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely being on your program.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, your book is beautiful. I'm really enjoying reading it. Where did I just put it? It's really great. And there's so many really great recipes. And, you know, I've been cooking vegan food for so many years, and there's things in here I've never done. So it's really always great to share with other vegan chefs, you know, things, other ideas, you know, because you always like to mix it up and get new ideas. So maybe you could just share with us a little bit about your journey. How did you come to being plant-based? Like, did you, when you decided you wanted to be a doctor, were you already plant-based? Was it your own personal experience? Maybe you can just share a little with us.
Yeah. So, you know, when I became plant-based, I was a practicing physician. I was practicing internal medicine, and I thought I knew about nutrition. I mean, I'm a doctor. I'm supposed to know, right? And I thought I was taking good care of myself, eating well. I was trying to eat the low carb way, actually. And I was exercising regularly. And I really thought I was doing everything right, except I was having so many health issues. I had pre-diabetes. I had high cholesterol levels. I struggled with my weight. I was carrying extra weight. I was overweight. And it wasn't just cosmetic. It was impacting my health. My knees would ache after I ran. I was diagnosed with osteoarthritis, which is this wear and tear arthritis. And at a very early age, I developed it. And then I developed more health issues such as asthma and allergies and heartburn. And it just seemed like I had my own medicine cabinet. It was like a mini walking pharmacy everywhere I went. I didn't feel great. So for all my medical education, and I was an avid runner, I was exercising, I didn't have much to show for my health. And then I was unfortunately diagnosed with thyroid cancer around that same time. And that was very, very jarring, because I thought, here I'm supposed to know how to take care of myself. And where did I go wrong? And, you know, whenever someone gets that diagnosis, we always ask why. What did I do? What could I have done to prevent it? And luckily for me, around that time, a good friend from medical school told me to pick up the China study, because he could hear how devastated I was. And I was very, very skeptical when I first started reading it. And I thought, vegan diet, that just does not sound right. If it was great, I would have learned about it in med school or in residency. But then the more I read the book, it all made sense. And why I was having these health issues, why we don't often help patients as much as we could be helping them. And that was the beginning of my new life, if you will, of eating plant-based.
Yeah, it's funny. I've spoken to so many medical doctors who have come to discover plant-based eating through the same similar journey. I mean, we all have these health issues and we think we know how to. I mean, I've been a vegetarian for, you know, over 40 years, and I've only started doing 100% plant-based for the last two. Prior to that, I guess I ate mostly that way, but not completely. And, you know, it's a journey. It's a journey, but it's really one that, you know, once you get there, you don't really want to turn back, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really amazing. As soon as I started it, I started to feel better, and everything just felt better. I felt healthier. I lost the weight. I reversed everything. And I kept thinking, if only I had always eaten this way, you know, the first half of my life could have been so different. Maybe I wouldn't have developed that thyroid cancer, but, you know, that's speculation, but still it's been amazing to eat this way.
And you said you were able to reverse your thyroid cancer?
No, not thyroid cancer. So the treatment for thyroid cancer is usually a thyroidectomy. So I had to have the surgery, and that meant taking lifelong thyroid medication, which is fine, but it's just, I always wonder in retrospect, you know, if eating differently might have prevented it for me. And again, we don't know, but it's something that I often think about.
Right. So, I know you've written many other books. What inspired you to write Simply Plant-Based?
Yeah, you know, I was running a plant-based weight loss program when I was practicing with Kaiser. And, you know, we had over 400 people come through our program and they really wanted to eat better. They believed in the science. They knew this could work for them and they were willing to try it. But where they got stuck was, I don't know what to put on the table. I don't know what to eat. I don't know how to make it taste good and enjoyable. And I thought, wow, that should not be what holds somebody back, because it's so easy to cook delicious plant-based meals and they're so satisfying. And I thought if I could just share what I'm making with them, maybe they would love it and gain the benefits that they need. And that is really what got me started on the book. And then as I did more research with the physicians committee, I noticed the same thing, that people just really want to eat better and they're willing to try this if they just know how to make it. And I wanted to put together recipes that were really easy, that were healthy, but that would also be delicious, because I didn't want people to think cooking well has to take hours and hours of work every day.
Right, right. Like even the recipe I shared, you know, it might sound really complicated, but it, you know, you're making use of canned beans and canned fire roasted mm-hmm. tomatoes, all organic. You know, yes, you could cook your beans yourself. You know, you can, you know, grow your own tomatoes, all that stuff. But we do have access to some really good quality resources and it pulls together dinner so fast. I mean, the fresh frozen corn, I use that. That's one. I'd say frozen corn and frozen peas are like the only vegetables that I use really frozen. But they add color and spark to so many recipes really quick, you know, last minute. And then there's also so many ingredients that people don't even know about. Like when people say, you know, what do you eat? Just salad all day? You know, they don't know about tamari or chickpea flour or, aji marin or tahini or, you know, all these staple ingredients, not to mention tofu, tempeh, seitan, you know, that we use for protein. So their palate is limited. What they, you know, their recipe or their ingredient list, if they're just using what they used when they cooked meat dishes, is really limited. They need to learn about some of these new products that are not new, but new to them in order to really expand and make the delicious food. So why do you think more healthcare providers aren't recommending a well-balanced plant-based diet?
You know, Bhavani, I think that's really a lack of knowledge. We as healthcare providers are not taught very much about nutrition. I know in my medical education, I wasn't taught much. We are taught a lot about disease treatment, not so much about prevention. So the focus is always on how to treat blood pressure with medication or how to treat heart disease with medication or procedures, but not really at how can diet and lifestyle prevent it? And if someone has it, how can it reverse it? And, you know, that is where the knowledge gap is. And if healthcare providers aren't recommending plant-based diets, it's because they just don't know about it. They don't know the research. They haven't read the studies, because once you read it, the evidence is very, very compelling. But it's this huge knowledge gap that we have right now that we really need to fill.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I think there's also the business of medicine. You know, I have interviewed at least two off the top of my head doctors who ran heart clinics who were closed down because they were recommending a plant-based diet. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the hospital was not doing procedures. They were getting people better with a plant-based diet, but they were not bringing in the money that they wanted to bring in. And so they got rid of that doctor and brought in another doctor that's doing the open heart surgeries. So, you know, there's always a question, you know, for me anyway, with medicine as to what's the motivation. You know, I always tell people follow the money. And unfortunately, so often that is the story that I'm hearing, that, you know, that so much of medicine is not really about prevention and keeping people healthy. It's about keeping hospitals going, pharmaceutical companies going, doctors going, and keeping the whole medical regime working like it, you know, like a well-oiled machine. which does not include making people healthy, because then they'd have no business. What's your take on that?
I mean, I think there is something to that. There is, it's very complicated why our medical education and our healthcare system is the way it is. But one thing is, a lot of medical research is funded by pharmaceutical industry. You know, there's really nobody out there funding whether tomatoes are healthy for us or whether black beans are healthy for us. So it's easier to fund a drug trial than it is to fund a dietary intervention, just for a variety of reasons. But that doesn't mean that's the right thing to do or that's what we should be doing. So we really need more NIH funding. We need more government funding to fund these research studies. And, you know, at the Physicians Committee, we do a lot of research looking at just these dietary interventions. But I think there are all sorts of special interests and outside groups that are influencing how things happen. And I think it's really important that we have programs like yours that are educating consumers, that are educating people how to empower themselves just by changing their diet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important. I mean, yesterday I read in the paper in the New York Times that they are no longer recommending low dose aspirin, that they've now realize that the side effects of taking a low dose aspirin every day is worse than and more likely to cause you harm than the heart disease that you might be preventing. Now, this has been a recommendation for how many years have they been recommending that? You know, and so there's so often times where, you know, science is so positive, this is what you should do and everybody should be on it. And then years later, you find out that's not necessarily the truth. You know, and I think that's some of what's going on, you know, in this whole vaccine thing that people are debating now, you know, with COVID. you know, I certainly got vaccinated because I wanted to be accepted by everybody and not be an outcast. But at the same time, I understand people's hesitancy when there's so much money involved mm-hmm. in profit for these companies, and they are the ones that are doing the testing on the research. You know, it's not the NIH, it's the pharmaceutical companies. So how do we give people confidence in the medical profession when so often things are, you know, recalled, called back? You know, my cousin was a DES baby, you know, she never could have children because she had no uterus because her mother took that medicine to prevent a miscarriage when she was pregnant. You know, so many things that are recommended end up coming back and not being so good. What's your feeling about that?
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. There's, you know, we have to remember every medication has side effects. It may have benefits. And so what we always want to do is have this conversation about the risks and benefits and see where each person lies. Now, there are some times where it's very clear, you know, if someone has pneumonia with 102 fever, their chest x-ray shows pneumonia, we would prescribe antibiotics. Of course, those antibiotics have side effects, but they could also be life-saving. And over there, the harm is far less than the benefit. But then there are things like aspirin, where it may not be so clear. The data may not be clear. And actually, that's one of the things that I really do love about a whole food plant-based diet is there really isn't a downside to it. You know, there are no risks. If we eat a balanced diet, if we take that B12 supplement, there's virtually no risk to us and we can only benefit. So, you know, it's really important to sometimes just take a step back and have that conversation with your healthcare provider. Tell me about the benefits. Tell me about the risks and tell me about alternatives. And really we've gone from this paternalistic culture in medicine of telling our patients what to do is to really empowering them and having that decision be a shared process. So I think it's very important for everyone to have that conversation with their healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm. And also to find a healthcare provider that is in alignment with what they believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, my husband has gone to his doctor, you know, and he was dealing with prostate issues. And that's part of the reason that he wanted to go plant-based, and it's healed him. Right. And he's been off the medication. And the doctor said, oh, that's just coincidence, it had nothing to do with him. Mm-hmm. He had to find another doctor, because if your doctor doesn't believe that what you eat affects your health, then you really, I think, need to find another doctor.
Yeah. And again, that gets back to that whole knowledge gap. And some healthcare providers simply don't know the strong connection between our health and our nutrition. So it is important to set those expectations. You know, when I meet a patient, I always ask, what are your goals for our visit today? So that we are aligned in what we're both working towards. Because if we're not, then it's not going to be a satisfying visit for the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you incorporate plant-based diets into your medical practice?
Well, you know, it's really a huge part of our practice. So when we meet new patients or we see follow-up patients, we always include questions about diet and lifestyle and really educating our patients, you know, saying, so if I have someone with high blood pressure, I don't just prescribe medication. I also talk to them about nutrition and the role sodium may be playing, and how they can minimize their sodium intake, and giving them helpful information, referring them to our dietitians who can work with them, really empowering them to understand more. So nutrition just plays such a key role in our health. And for us, it's that other option we always offer to our patients. You know, it's not just medications. We also have nutrition, and we need to focus on that because that's really the backbone of our health here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so how does a plant-based diet impact weight loss? Do you use that as a method for weight loss?
Well, I don't know if it's a method, but it's a natural outcome. Eating a healthy plant-based diet, people are going to eat foods that are low in fat. They're going to eat foods that have a lower caloric density. They're going to eat foods that are rich in fiber. And so what they're going to find is they're eating more volume of food, but overall losing weight because the caloric density is so much lower. Plants are loaded with fiber, whereas animal foods have no fiber. And so when people eat a plant-based diet, they naturally lose weight. And it's a welcome side effect for most people.
Absolutely. And how does a plant-based diet impact diabetes?
Yeah, you know, this is where we have such good research evidence for both weight loss, diabetes, and even heart disease, that what really causes blood sugar levels to rise is insulin resistance. So we may have insulin, but it's just not able to do its job. And what causes insulin resistance is the amount of fat in our food plays a big role in that. So if we eat a high fat meal, contrary to popular belief, it's not the sugar, it's really the fat in our food. High fat meals make our insulin less effective. And so blood sugar levels tend to stay up. And when people eat a low fat plant-based diet, they find their blood sugar levels go down, and they go down very quickly. And we see this with our patients. I've had many patients who have been able to reverse their diabetes within a matter of months just by changing their diet, you know, without any medications. It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. And what about protein? You know, that's one of the questions I get all the time. People are like, well, where do you get your protein from? How are you going to have enough protein? And my response is always like, you know, the amount of protein people think we need is somewhat of a myth. We don't need the quantities that people have. I mean, I've had many doctors say to me that they've never met a patient in America with a protein deficiency, you know? So what's your answer to that question? Because I'm sure you get it also.
Yeah, there's this sort of this myth in the popular culture that somehow we're protein deficient, and that's the reason why we are becoming heavier as a society or we're having health problems. So this is really easy. Let's break this down. We only need about 10 to 15% of our daily calories to come from protein. That's it, just 10 to 15%. And that's probably being generous. We probably need less than that. So how do you get 10 to 15% of your calories from plants? Super easy. Fruits tend to be low in protein, so about 5% of the calories. But vegetables, about 10 to 50%. Even something like onions are 10% protein. And then whole grains are about 10 to 15%. And then if we start looking at legumes like hard beans, dried beans, lentils, these are just powerhouses of protein where anywhere from 20 to 40% of the calories are from protein. So you can see how easy it is to get to that 10 to 15%. Unless someone is just exclusively eating fruits, they're going to get plenty of protein. It's not going to be an issue at all.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I like to tell people is that, to extract the protein from vegetables or grains, your organs actually have to work harder than when you give them protein from meat. It's so easy for them to get that protein that your organs become sluggish. But actually, your organs, in order to get the protein from the vegetables and the grains, has to work harder. It's almost like exercising your organs to extract that protein. That was from Rudolf Steiner, a philosopher, and that was his belief. And I share that with people because I love the thought of it. You know, whether it's true or not, I don't know. But just the idea that, you know, it makes sense that your organs could become sluggish if you just give them so much heavy meat, chicken, you know, that's like 100% protein and there's, you know, so little else in it. And that, you know, your organs have to work to extract the protein from vegetables and grains. So I like that imagery, but that's just a personal thing. So can you give an example of your recipes that provide, a high protein for those that are concerned?
Yeah, so really anything using beans or legumes would be great options. If you're looking for a super easy recipe, try the quick and easy lentil soup. It is literally ready in 10 minutes, so it's a great option. And lentils are about 20% protein.
Is that cooking it in a pressure cooker?
No, this is cooking on a stovetop with just a saucepan. So it's using the orange or red lentils, which cook very, very quickly. They don't even require pre-soaking. And within 5 minutes of boiling, they are soft and good to go.
Really?
Yeah, they're wonderful. They're my go-to when I don't have anything prepared. I can put a nice soup on the table in 10 minutes. And then you can try something like black beans, which you were talking about, black bean quesadillas or nachos, super easy to get those on the table. You can do anything with tofu. So a scrambled tofu is a recipe in the book, or a tofu lasagna with vegetables in it. Tofu is about 40% protein. So really, it's so easy to get protein. These are just some of the higher protein meals, but even just vegetables like cauliflower wings that I have a recipe for in there, we're going to get our daily requirements for protein from that. So it's very easy. Again, unless we're just eating fruits, we will get those proteins in.
Yeah. Yeah. Like everybody I've interviewed has always said, no one in this country has a protein deficiency. It's just almost impossible. Now, a lot of people have fear about soy. There's like a myth out there. I almost feel like it was started by like the meat industry, you know, to make people afraid of eating soy because it's a substitute for meat so often. What are your feelings on soy products? I mean, there's so many countries that have been eating it for years and they had low cancer rates. I mean, this fear of people with soy makes me nuts. Can you share some light on that, please?
Yeah, I'm so glad you're asking that because you're right. There is this fear of soy, and soy hasn't been a big part of the American cuisine. You know, in parts of Asia, it plays a huge role. But let's really talk about soy. It's made from soybeans, and it can be found. You can have it as soybeans or edamame or tofu or tempeh, all great options. And the biggest fear I think that's out there is soy causes breast cancer. So let's dispel that right now. If you haven't heard this already, in the human breast, there are two types of estrogen receptors. One that binds estrogen that's produced either by our own bodies or that's synthetically produced. And when estrogen binds to those receptors, the risk for breast cancer increases. However, there's another estrogen receptor that binds to the phytoestrogens, which are these natural plant estrogens that are found in soy. And when those estrogens bind to the receptor in the breast, they decrease the risk of breast cancer. And this has been shown repeatedly in research that women who consume more soy have a lower, not higher, lower risk of breast cancer. And even in women who've had breast cancer, soy consumption reduces the risk of recurrence. So that's huge. But not only does soy reduce the risk of breast cancer, it has so many other health benefits. It helps improve our bone density. And we now have research from the Physicians Committee showing that soybeans can help with hot flashes. You know, for women who are transitioning through menopause, hot flashes are very bothersome. And, you know, half a cup of soybeans a day can have a tremendous positive impact in reducing that. So there's so many great benefits. And let me also say lastly, soy does not cause breast development in men. So it's safe for boys, it's great for women, and it's delicious. It's such a great way to cook. You can make kebabs or scrambled tofu. It's so versatile. You can make desserts with it. I mean, the list just goes on and on what you can do with soy.
Yeah. One of the things I used to do was I was a private chef for people with different health issues, right? So I would cook for people with cancer, diabetes, that kind of thing. And one of my clients who had breast cancer, you know, she was undergoing chemo. And, you know, I was told that, you know, miso soup is very good for counteracting that radiation, that or the chemo chemical, whatever. So I said, I made you a big pot of miso soup. It's very good for your health. And she said, oh, no, I can't have miso. It has soy. Meanwhile, she's carrying in a box of Dunkin' Donuts. Right. And I'm like, the doctor told you not to have soy, but he didn't say don't have sugar. We all know sugar feeds cancer, not soy. And so, you know, it baffles me that still today, you know, that doctors will tell patients who have breast cancer, stay away from soy, and not say stay away from sugar or stay away from chicken with hormones and antibiotics, or, you know, not to stay away from the other things, or to eat organic, or stay away from GMOs. None of that. It's just stay away from soy. Like, it's this big boulder of horribleness. And
yeah, I think that just gets back to the whole nutrition gap, you know, the knowledge gap between what research shows and what providers know and what they're telling their patients. So we really need to bridge that gap, because we have great research, but that information isn't making its way into providers who are then giving advice about nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Well, in medical school, for instance, how many hours of nutrition training do you get? I was told it's like 5 hours in your whole 4 years of medical school.
Yeah, it's minimal. You know, I know for us, we had maybe half an hour of nutrition education. And most of the education that we get is not practical nutrition education. It's about complex biochemistry. What's the structure of a carbohydrate? What's the structure of a trans fat or a fat? And which, while that's helpful for us to know, that doesn't translate into helpful advice we can give to our patients. So we need more practical information about what do these chemical structures mean for food on our plate, and what do they mean for our health?
Mm-hmm. Last week, I actually was invited to Southampton Hospital, and I do this every year, a cooking demo for the residents there. And so there's about 40 residents, and I do a cooking demo and show, you know, do a whole full plant-based meal, showing them about it. And that's after they first watched Michael Pollan's movie, Food Inc. Mm-hmm. So they really get a sense of, even though that's old, it's still such a great film. Or he's also showed What the Health. I'm sure you've seen that film as well. You know, so they get some education about nutrition, and then also how easy it is to cook plant-based food. Another physician that I've interviewed actually went to the Natural Gourmet Cooking School to learn how to cook this food so he could actually teach other doctors and teach his patients, you know, because in order for doctors to teach it or to tell patients about it, they need to eat that way or know about it. And I think the majority of doctors don't. Is there any movement to try to really train doctors in plant-based eating?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, at the Physicians Committee, we do a lot to educate and advocate for plant-based nutrition. We have the we have an international conference on nutrition and medicine every year, where we'll have over 1,000 attendees come, and we bring in leading experts from around the world, and we review the latest data on nutrition and health. And the idea is to give people that education, the latest research news and education that they can then carry over into their practices. We also provide nutrition-related CME for healthcare providers. So if providers would like to learn more about nutrition, they can go to our website, they can watch these CME videos or read online, and it's all free, and it's just a great way to learn. And then we often will go and speak at local hospitals or medical schools, or we've even traveled to India to educate medical students there and physicians about the role of nutrition in health. So there is a lot of work to do, and we're doing it, and you know, it's having an impact. More and more physicians are learning, they're recommending it to their patients. And a lot of it is coming from patients too. They're learning about it from programs like yours, and they're coming to us and saying, I want to see you because you're plant-based and I want you to help me manage some of my health conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Because we really need to push this movement, because it's also really so much better for the planet. I mean, the amount of industrial agriculture that we are doing and the way we are raising animals and treating animals just has to stop. It's inhumane. So that's just a whole nother side. I don't want to go there, but it's just, you know, it's really important. Can you talk a little bit about omega-3 fats and also about omega-6? You know, I know people, when you stop eating fish, they're so worried that you're not going to get your omega-3s. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so omega-3 fats are a type of polyunsaturated fat that we need. And some omega-3, and there are two types of polyunsaturated fats. There's omega-3 and omega-6. And omega-3s are found to be helpful to lower the risk of chronic disease. So people can consume alpha-linolenic acid, or ALA, from plant-based sources, and the body can then convert it to DHA and EPA, which are important for our heart and brain health. Now, people could get these omega-3s, DHA, EPA directly from fish. However, the problem is when you get that from fish, not only do you get the omega-3, you also get a lot of cholesterol, you get a lot of fat, and then there's mercury.
And you get a lot of plastic.
Yeah. And there's there are a lot of environmental and ethical aspects to it too. So it's so much easier to get it from plants. So how can you get it from plants? Well, it's really easy. Omega-3s are rich in walnuts or flaxseed or chia seeds. So the question really is, how much of these omega-3s do you need in a day? So for, you know, boys age 14 plus, they need about 1600 milligrams a day. And girls 14 plus need about 1100. And let me show you how easy it is to get that. 1 ounce of walnuts, which is not a lot of walnuts, have about 2500 milligrams. Or 1 tablespoon of flax has 2300 milligrams. Or 1 tablespoon of chia has 2000. So we don't need to worry about this deficiency very much. You know, half a tablespoon of flax or chia, or even half an ounce of walnuts, we can get our omega-3s. It's really not a big nutrient of concern. I think it just became one of those hyped up nutrients because the average American was consuming so much saturated fat, and we wanted to discourage that. But that doesn't mean that we're somehow omega-3 deficient.
Mm-hmm. And does the flaxseed or chia seeds or walnuts, do they lose any of that omega-3 if you cook them? Because I know I very often grind my flax seeds up and I use them. I actually make my imitation egg using flaxseed or chia seed, because when you mix it with water, as you, I'm sure, know, it becomes kind of glutinous and helps bind things together. So very often I'm making a vegan egg using a tablespoon of flaxseed and a tablespoon of chia seeds, but then it's getting cooked in whatever I'm cooking. Does that affect the omega-3?
No, you know, we don't know. There are many ways to eat these, but it's probably fine however we're consuming them. If we look at the National Institutes of Health and where they talk about omega-3s, they say there's virtually no known deficiency of omega-3s in the United States. So it's, again, another one of those things that's become this popular nutrient of concern, but it need not be. We will get plenty of it. And it's not just in these things. You know, omega-3s are also found in edamame. It's also found in beans. So there are many ways to get it, and they all add up to significant amounts.
Mm-hmm. And another one that people always ask me about is vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to get that, or is that you need to take a supplement for that?
Yeah, so that, you know, I say that is the one supplement that we should all be taking, especially for following a plant-based diet. Vitamin B12 is an essential vitamin that we need that our bodies cannot make. And when people eat animal foods, they get vitamin B12 because the bacteria in those animals' guts produce the B12, and that's how people get it. But when we eat a plant-based diet, we're not getting that. So it is really important to take it. And it's super easy. We need very little. We need just about 2.5 micrograms a day, a very minuscule amount. And you can take an over-the-counter supplement like 500 micrograms a day and, you know, take that a few times a week, and that should be plenty.
So you won't get that vitamin B12 by eating fermented foods?
So you could, but it's not, they're not a reliable source. So people can get it from nutritional yeast. You know, a lot of plant-based milks are fortified with B12. But, you know, so let's even take something like soy milk, which has vitamin B12 in it. Usually it's been fortified with it, but you really have to shake it before you pour it. So if someone forgets to shake it, they may not get the B12. And because it's such an important vitamin and supplements are very inexpensive, relatively harmless and easy to take, I think to be on the safe side, it's good to just take one. But if you're ever in doubt, you can always have your levels checked. They're easy to do, and they can give a good indication of where we are.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a favorite kitchen tool that you want to share with my listeners? I know I certainly do. I'd love to hear what yours is.
Oh, well, I'd love to hear yours too. I have so many, but I think the thing that I use on an almost daily basis is my high-powered blender. I love it. I use it to make fruit ice cream, like banana ice cream or frozen strawberry ice cream. I use it to make soups. I used to make tomato sauce, salsas. And the other one that I use almost daily is my electric pressure cooker. It just makes it so easy to cook those lentils and legumes and beans, and it's very easy to use. So those are my two go-to. How about you, Pavni? What do you like?
Well, I've been using an Instapot just recently. You know, I had my pressure cooker that was a stovetop, but I didn't have room in my kitchen really, so I kept it out in the garage. I'd have to bring it in, so I didn't use it often. But I've been doing renovation in my kitchen, so that I've been using the Instapot a lot because I haven't had access to my kitchen, and it's been great. And it has, you know, the air fryer in it. It has the Instapot. It has the pressure cooker in it. It's a saute thing. So I've been using the Instapot a lot lately. But I'd say one thing I use every day is my little mini food chopper, because I use that for chopping my ginger and garlic, because I use a lot of ginger and garlic, and it just minces it so easily. And there's nothing like fresh, you know, fresh ginger and garlic. So I use that all the time. And then I also make lots of my salad dressings in there daily. So I use that a lot. And then, of course, good knives. Can't live without good knives, right? It's so important. True. I remember my cousin who's, you know, she was cooking carrots, and she's using like a little steak knife to cut the carrot pieces. And I was like, oh my God, you know, wonder why, if you don't have a good knife, trying to cut carrots with a little steak knife is going to take you forever.
Yeah.
And you're never going to do it. So you have to really have good sharp knives to cook vegetables well.
And you know, you're so right. Helpful kitchen tools don't just have to be expensive items. A good knife, a good cutting board, a lemon press, a garlic press. Yeah. These can all be so useful and just save so much time.
Yeah. And so, yeah, time savers are a real thing. You know, I really emphasize people, you know, remembering their freezer. You know, when I make brown rice, I usually make a double batch. I almost always, actually, very often I make a triple batch. And I make one for that night, one for like 2 or 3 days down the road, and one batch that I put in the freezer so that I have two portions worth frozen that I can easily pull out and, you know, defrost super fast. If you have it, you know, sandwiched flat in a plastic bag, that's how I like to freeze the things, you know, so that it's easy to defrost as opposed to big clump that takes a while. I freeze it flat, you know, I do that with my vegetables too, try to freeze them flat so that they defrost really easy. And they're also really easy to stack in the freezer that way. So you know, those are some of my tips.
That's a really good tip about freezing your own food. I find like even freezing pasta or sauces or soups, it's just so wonderful instead of buying a frozen meal to just kind of create your own. And then when you're in a pinch, there it is. And it has saved me many. I've even frozen oatmeal or pudding before, and it all keeps really well. So always a good option.
Yeah. And we are just about out of time. So can you share before we end the website for the Physicians for Responsible Medicine? Is that where you said the videos are? And are they open to anybody to watch?
So we have a couple of websites. We have PCRM.org that people can go to. And we have a ton of information there about nutrition. People can look up, healthcare providers can find information about CME. They can access the videos by creating an account there. And all the wonderful information we have, it's always free. There's a lot in there. And then I also practice at the Barnard Medical Center in Washington, D.C. And people can go to barnardmedical.org and also look up information about our practice. And we have a lot of helpful information there too about nutrition and health. So both great resources. And if you follow the links there, you can find all sorts of wonderful information.
Now, is everyone at Barnard Medical Center, like are all of your colleagues there practicing plant-based?
Yeah, we are. Isn't
really?
That something? Yeah, we are a completely vegan office, and it's just really wonderful because we all share the same mission, we share the same passion, and oh boy, you should come to our potlucks when we have them. It is so much fun to see
wonderful
great and creations.
I saw on your website you actually do telemedicine too, so people, if they are not in DC, they can still have access to your expertise, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. At our practice, I think we see people from over 20 different states, and I am licensed in 11 states. So telehealth has been a great way for us to connect with patients throughout the country.
Wonderful. Well, I just want to thank you so much. Your information
thank you.
Is so great, and I love what you're doing, and please keep spreading the word on plant-based eating and helping people get better and healthier. Thank you.
Thank you, Pavni, and same for your work. Thank you for all that you're doing.
Of course. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And Dr. Vanita Raman has been my guest at the Barnard Medical Center and Physician Committee for Responsible Medicine. Thank you all. See you all again next week. Bye for now.